the Cardboard Mechanics Podcast, where we take a look under the hood of board games and talk about the mechanisms and narratives that drive design.
We didn't think through an intro, did we?
No, not really.
Yeah, I kind of figured that's how the most of this is going to go. Welcome to Cardboard Mechanics. We're going to talk about a game that is near and dear to our hearts and our shelves. That's Sovereign Skies.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to talk about mainly about the mechanics of Sovereign Skies, because both John and I did work on the game. It is my kind of magnum opus, really my first game that I signed. It's actually not my first published game, but I did sign it with Deepwater in 2017, and then I got John to help me work on the solo version, and John pretty much developed that in about a day, I would say, John. And it's absolutely genius, using all of the components that are already there. So we were able to make it turn it from a 2 to 4 player game into a solo to 4 player game. So anyway, so we're going to talk about, I think, just about mainly kind of the mechanics and why, and really revolving around what the main mechanic is, which is a rondel. So John, I don't know if you want to talk about how you feel about rondels, what other rondels you might have experienced, and then we can talk a little bit about kind of why this became a rondel from its kind of previous iterations.
So I guess first thing to really talk about is to, you know, we can't assume everybody knows exactly what a rondel is. I know that you live and die by the rondel.
I do.
And the good thing is that if you die by the rondel, you just go all the way back around and get back to yourself anyway. So,
that's right, reincarnate.
It's the Ouroboros of the board game world. So rondel is a mechanic, usually where there's some set of actions. And in some games, you just kind of have free choice to do whatever you please. And that can be fun in its own ways. But I think that creativity and fun, sometimes you need good constraints. And a rondel does that in a really cool way, where it puts all the actions in usually a circle. Not always, but we're just going broad general strokes. There's always going to be those, well, technically kind of things that when it comes to stuff like categorizations like this, but usually you put them in a circle and you have a token and you can move your token around the circle, and whatever space you land on, you get to do the thing, whatever the thing is. And so it creates this really interesting scenario in a lot of games where you have a broad range of things you want to do. You have a goal you want to get to, but it's hard to get to do exactly what you want to do all the time. You have to be a little creative with the way you get there because, well, it's going to cost me this many bucks to go that many spaces, but I don't want to spend all that money because then I won't have the money to buy this thing, to do that thing. So, you know, you kind of have to get really creative in the way that you're going to position yourself around the wheel. You have to kind of sometimes do a bunk action to get something a little better later. You kind of have to finagle your brain around how to best orient this wheel to keep your vehicle moving.
Yeah.
So fun mechanic, a lot of fun. I mean, like I said, I think adding restriction to choice is definitely like a big part of games, right? If you give too much freedom, it sometimes gets a little wild. So a little restriction can be good.
Yeah, and I'll play off that a little bit, basically talking about kind of where I started and how it got to kind of that rondel state. Originally, it was sort of these six planets where it was just you're almost run-of-the-mill worker placement where you could just kind of place anywhere you wanted to go. And every time you would place a ship down, you would leave a ship behind and then do an action there. And you were sort of leaving these ships and building them up, and you have this area control going on. But one thing that I realize is you have, in the beginning, especially when somebody's learning a game, you're looking at all of these choices and it just becomes a little AP. Well, when you're starting to play Sovereign Skies, you start on a planet, you know your next two planets you're going to go are going to be free for you. And that is going to be maybe a little less debilitating for somebody who's new to the game, who doesn't necessarily have a complete understanding of all of the actions, all of those six special actions. So your decision space is kind of, you know, minimized to some degree, so that as you become richer and as the game goes on and as you learn more and remember more about what all those actions are, your decision space will open up because you can pay to go further and have a larger decision space. So I think that's really kind of where that came from. Right. Also, there's something that's semi-unique, I think, in Sovereign Skies. And I know there are a couple of games that do this as well. But, you know, typically in a rondel, you kind of go clockwise. Clockwise is sort of that thing in board games where we know that everybody who's, you know, sitting down at a table, the next person, you know, in a round is going to be in clockwise order. And the same thing goes for rondels a lot of the time, where you're just going clockwise. You can go one or two spaces and take those actions. Well, in Sovereign Skies, not only can you pay to go further, but you can also pay to turn around and go the other way, to go counterclockwise. And I think that is something that's pretty unique for this as well. And that, you know, when we're looking at mechanics and we're talking about mechanics and design, one thing we like to look for is, where is that twist? What other things are we bringing to the table with this kind of tried and true mechanic? And I think that's one thing that kind of does something a little bit differently than a lot of other rondels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it's like, again, all these genres are always going to have those little, you know, exceptions to the rule, right? And I think it's one that's like, it's not too hard to process. Like a lot of games, and you mentioned kind of that ramp up in difficulty. It's a thing where like a lot of people can kind of ignore it for a little bit and go, okay, well, I've got these couple choices, right? Because I think a lot of games present choices, and it's a big thing in games when presenting choices, like, you know, kind of to compare, like, because rondels and worker placements kind of have like this similarity of like, here's a bunch of actions, you're kind of choosing them. I guess action point allowance kind of has a similar deal, but that's a little more in depth. But, you know, worker placement rondel, one piece goes one place, does something, right? So when you kind of tie it, like you look at a game like Caverna, where this is big, broad, or like Fields of Arl, or I guess I just like Rosenberg, huh? or you talk about Agricola. So these kind of games where you just have this broad range of spaces and you put a dude and it's like, well, where do I go? I mean, my first time playing Fields of Arl, I'm just like, yeah, that's a lot of spaces. With these, Feast it gives Odin. You that limited selection. Yeah, if he's for another Rosenberg. With this game, yeah, you have a couple options, but a lot of times it's like, do I want option A or option B? And then as the game goes on, you start to add in option C and then D. And really, turning around at the beginning of the game is not really super, like, it costs a lot of energy, so you don't really, you can just kind of phase it out of your brain. You're like, nah, I don't care. But then as the game goes on, you get more energy, you start to get that option and go, ooh, now I have this other option. And so, like, it starts out good, because, like, I think when you're giving players decisions, two decisions is pretty easy, because one of them is better than the other. Like, and I mean, maybe they're not, but like it helps people to weigh it out to go, well, this one is better than that one. Like, I think a lot of times people can find the good and the bad, like given two things, people can make a decision. When you add in that third thing immediately, now there's so many things to weigh out. There's so many possibilities. It just has like exploded because, you know, if you present people a rock and a paper, you're like, well, paper covers rock. I want the paper. But then once you put in the scissors, you get the whole Princess Bride situation where, well, I want the rock because it beats the scissors. But what if they pick the paper, then I want the scissors. So like it gets this whole cyclical thing. And then in your head, you can kind of self-defeat yourself with all the options. So like kind of presenting just a few options to start, really good. It's like a really good ramp up. And because the economy of the game is getting the energy, the economy of the game is tied to the decision space in the game.
Yep.
Which I think a lot of engine building styled games do that. And this one has light engine building to it. Not a ton, not like a super in-depth, massive empire. But, you know, you do get more energy as you go and you start to get more cards and stuff and things. So you're amassing stuff, stuff being a generic term for things. but those give you more decisions. And so it's nice because... instead of just dropping you in an open warehouse and saying, what do you want? We got one of everything. It's like, well, here, you got a couple things you can pick. What would you like? And then that helps you to get into the flow of the game, make some early decisions, instantly regret them, but then also get to experience the fun of building up and growing and, you know, kind of doing the thing. And as you're understanding, you're also growing in what you can do, which means you learn at the same pace at which you play almost, like, which is amazing. That's really good. I think that's something a lot of games get backwards, where they just drop you on the first turn and say, here, you can do anything you want.
Yeah.
So what do I want to do?
So let's just talk quickly about the difference between worker placement and worker movement. One thing I wanted to mention was, you know, kind of transitioning from worker placement to worker movement. And I don't even think I had that term in my brain when I started working in this direction. Right. But the fact that you're moving just one piece and you're not leaving that piece behind, which is what you do in worker placement. You place a piece, you get stuff, you leave that behind until it's recalled or until it's replaced, something like that, mm-hmm. until it's bumped. So that's typical in most worker placement games. In worker movement, you're just moving the same piece over and over again. And every time you move it, you are going to sort of get what you would get in a worker placement game, all the benefits or some of the benefits of where you move to. And that was mm-hmm. the idea. And it seemed a lot more thematic, right? That you have this mothership, you can place ships down, you can leave ships behind, but those aren't actually getting you something other than this other kind of mechanic in the game, which is area majority. Mm-hmm. So moving to that worker movement, I thought was a really cool kind of tie-in for the theme. And also, that's really kind of part of what a rondel is, right? It's basically a worker movement sort of mechanic.
Yeah. It's interesting here because, like, I think worker movement a lot of times is less blocky than, like, worker placement. Worker placement is, like, a competition for time, for I was the first person to place there, it's my space. Rondels not as often have the blocking. They do sometimes, but it's kind of each, like, a thing. I know, like... Heaven and Ale and
yes,
Glenmore.
Yes, sometimes you got to jump over the next person or you can't land in the same spot.
Nope.
I think it was really important, especially a game that's kind of, that has the limitations that this one does, that everybody's kind of allowed to do the thing mm-hmm. they want to do and they're not going to get blocked out necessarily.
Right.
And instead, the whoever is kind of dominant in that place is going to get a benefit, but you're not going to necessarily get punished for going there.
Right. Yeah. It's very soft in that regard, in that it's not super hands-on punchy, but it's still interactive, right? Like, it's nice because if I want to go to, Wern next turn, you can't really stop me from doing that. You may be able to change right. the implications of that, of what I'm going to do, but you can't stop me from doing the thing I want to do next turn for the most part. Right. And I think that's great. Like, I think that's good because it is definitely a thing where, like, it keeps the game moving, where people can think about what they want to do next turn. And they can have a couple turns planned out or have their next turn planned or whatever. And it keeps the game moving because when the situations change like that, it kind of can add to the analysis paralysis, the AP of it, where, okay, so my next turn I'm going to do this, and then the very next player does the thing you wanted to do. They block you from it, and you're like, oh, okay, well, hold on, let me rethink this. And then you rethink your plan, and then the next player also blocks you. So, you know, it makes it to where it's kind of frustrating to try and think about sometimes, because you're just constantly getting stepped on. And here you can kind of create a 10-year plan and find your way, okay, I'm gonna do this, then next turn this, and it's nice. And then the situations may change and you may, decide, oh well, I don't need that card anymore because this senator flipped out and well, I want to buy that one instead, or now I have this power. So things can change. You can't script the whole game front to back, like an AI or a robot might, but you can at least kind of have some foresight into what's going to be happening. I think that also helps too. This game, it just does a really good job of and we're tooting our own horns, sorry. But it does a really good job of kind of onboarding people, getting them in, and letting them do the satisfying thing, right? There's not a whole lot here that prevents you from doing the cool thing, which is good. That's fun. That's why you play games, is for those good, cool moments of, I did this cool thing, I had this cool experience. So,
yeah. And there's sort of this mix between, and I think a lot of games that I like to play personally do this, where there's a mix of strategy and kind of tactical decision-making as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously if, another player does something before you, they take that high value chit before you do, that may change your plans to some degree. Mm-hmm. It may change kind of it makes you have to pivot in maybe what you're trying to do. But for the most part, you can plan ahead. You can go to that next special action that you want to do.
Right.
And to give a little backstory, if you don't know how Sovereign Skies works, basically it's really just a race game. So there are piles of kind of chits around the board that kind of devalue as they disappear, as they're depleted, these stacks. When two stacks finish, the game ends. So you're kind of racing to get the most high value ones first. One way you can do that is to collect the cards. Each planet has its own kind of basically resource, which is a politic card. And each senator's cost two different politic cards. So those senators will give you an extra power, an extra action really to use in the game. And those extra actions is really what helps drive you to getting more faster, mm-hmm. right? And that's sort of the idea. If you're racing, you want to get to the thing, to the next thing faster and faster. So getting there first is really important. Also, what I wanted to talk about was sort of, you have this primary decision each turn that you're going to make, kind of where you want to go for the next special action that you want to do. Say I want to go and I want to take my drop ships and turn those into a base. Well, I have to go to, now I got to look at like my game to actually figure that out. So now I got to go to Hereja, which is an orange planet. That's activate. I'm wrong. To build a base, you got to go to Utie. And that is a purple planet. And I've got to make it to this spot if I really want to turn my dropships into a base. And each one of these planets have a cost for turning those dropships into a base. It's either going to be 2, 3, or 4, depending on the color of the planet. So if I want to do that, I'm thinking ahead, okay, that's going to be my next turn. I know that I'm going to do that. But there's also a secondary decision space that you have to deal with once you get to the planet, right? Your first move is to go there and to pay that cost, whatever that may be, of energy, depending on how far away from that planet you are. But once you're there, then you have another set of decisions that you're going to make. Are you going to do just one action, the one that you're there to do? Are you going to do two actions, or are you going to do all three actions that are on the planet? Now, this was a really kind of interesting thing once we started going through development for this and Ian Zhang and I worked together very closely in development on this. And this was really an Ian idea about allowing players to sort of have this income if they decided not to do all of the actions. And that was actually absent from the game for a very long time. And what we saw in playtesting was there were players that were getting stuck without energy, without any sort of income, and they had to just go to the next planet and do something there. And they couldn't get more energy unless they had that income from Area Majority, or they landed on the planet that gave them actual energy, which was Solinmir, where you can get two energy and plus one for each base that you have. Now, what we decided was, well, we want to make it so that anyone who may use up all their energy has an opportunity each turn to just earn more energy. The way you do that is to only do one action. If you do just one action, you get an energy. If you do two actions, you don't lose any, you don't pay any. If you do all three actions, you actually pay an energy. So that was just a really kind of interesting development in the game to create this new crunchy decision that you had to make. Like, it's really, it can really help you to do all three actions at the beginning of this game, especially because you really want to get those dropships out. You really want to pick up those politic cards, and you really want to do that special action for each one of those planets. But especially towards the end of the game, you may be fine. You, for one, you can't have more than one instance of any of the politic cards. So you may land on a planet where you already have that card. You don't need that. So that's one action you don't have to do. The other, you might already be dominating there and have three bases there or something, and you don't have to put any dropships down. You're fine. So all you're doing is doing that one special action and getting an energy for doing that. And that always feels good when you can kind of dominate and be there and have that easy decision to make as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think the kind of clever thing here for me anyways, right, because I kind of broke down the economy on this, and this really led into kind of the development of the bot. So we're gonna swing on this. So you know, the actions, I believe, a long time ago cost an energy each. And I think the kind of solution, why don't you just give players an income? And if you look at this chart, right, if you do, there's three actions you can do. And if you do one of them, you get an energy. If you do all three, you pay an energy. And when you calculate that out, it's basically just each player has an income of two every turn. You have an you have an income of two, and you pay one per action. But I think that's more complicated than this little simple do one, get a bonus energy, do all three, pay an energy. And it's just like, it gets rid of that step of moving pieces, which is fun. It's fun to, oh, look at me, I get my two. But that's an easy thing to forget. Oh, I forgot to get my two. Did I get my two?
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. I remember when you said that, and I said, yeah, there's a psychology there for sure. Mm-hmm. Going there and you're not taking something and then doing all of the accounting for each one of those turns. It feels very fiddly, and it takes that fiddliness out and it makes it super simple.
Yeah. It just get bakes one, it in. Yeah.
Yeah. Get one for one. Neither for two, or pay one for three. Right. And it's just, it's just so, it just simplifies that. Well, and that's, I think that was a good lesson in design for me as well. Mm-hmm. To try to simplify in kind of the rule writing as much as possible.
Right.
That was just an interesting sort of take on that economy.
Yeah. So I think that's super cool, right? That you bake that automatic income in to make it a simpler thing. But then also the other draw that it has, you have a limited pool of energy, which, I mean, it wouldn't be very much fun if you just had unlimited energy. So that makes sense. You've got this limited pool of energy you're trying to use to do these things as efficiently as possible. And so you want to use the energy to move to get the correct actions. You also want to use it to just get more actions, right? So how do you you restrict the player in that they can do less actions, so you want to get more energy. It kind of ties itself to itself again, the economy of the game. As your economy expands, your options also expand, and then you have to choose those correct options. So that's super cool, and I like that a lot. And so the way I kind of thought about this, and the way it kind of tied into the robot, is that, like, usually a player, if you just go forward a space and you take two actions, you are energy neutral, right? Like, you don't spend any energy, you don't gain any energy, you just kind of do the stuff. But you may not be getting the best options there. That's where spending your energy to do the third action, or to move some extra spaces, or to only take one action to get the bonus energy may assist you in trying to finagle your way into, like, a situation where you have a better economy and you can take the correct actions more often, or in the correct order, right? And so for the robot, kind of the way I had it, I was like, well, you know, if a player does less actions smartly, would it beat a robot that is doing more actions dumbly? And the answer is sometimes. And so really just kind of I had the robot just doesn't care about that cost. It just does them all. So basically, in a very kind of soft roundabout way, the robot just kind of gets one extra income. And it does the actions in a dumb order. So it just picks a space and does them all. It drops the drop ship. It takes the politic card and performs some special action. It does all of them. Now, a player is going to try and formulate those in a way that makes sense and go, I want to do this. You know, I want to put the ships down and then I want to build the base and then I want to activate the base, right? A robot's just going to go, I don't know, I picked that one. So sometimes the robot's not going to do the best thing. Sometimes it'll do the best thing possible. You know, that's part of it. It's a solo game, so you want it to play and streamline. You don't want to have to make lots of decisions. And like, you know, part of playing a solo board game, I do play a good handful of solo board games. You don't really want to have to manage a whole lot on the other side of things. So you just kind of want this robot to do a thing, like really, like to give the illusion of playing against somebody that is, you know, doing well. And so if you just have them do a quantity of things, it seems like they're doing something. And like, it's artificial intelligence. And I stress the word artificial. it's not incredibly smart, but it's sometimes doing things in the right order. It's kind of neat how it, you know, ended up working out. And so really, like when I kind of peeled back the hood of your economy there and I looked at it, I'm like, oh, okay, well, it just does more things, but in a worse order. So, you know, that's kind of how that idea came together. And we made it, you know, use the cards, use the other sets of cards that you're not using, because you have four politic cards of each suit, but you're only using one of them per player. So the other three were free. And I'm like, well, that's easy. That's your AI right there. Your brain is a stack of cards. So, you know, we had like, it kind of came together and it worked pretty well. I had to kind of touch on the actions to make them work a little better. And then we tried some other silly stuff, like making we kind of had like the order of the things of the pieces, the planets and the circle they were in, that had influence at one point. I think at that point I was trying to overdevelop and make it have a like an actual brain, and that was too much.
Yeah.
But I mean, well, you know.
Yeah. What happened was it made it so that certain games were really hard and certain ones were really easy.
Right.
Because the AI just, it, for some reason, that wasn't functioning correctly. One thing that I want to point out that was, I thought was brilliant, was the fact that the AI never spends any energy, but does collect energy, meant that it sort of created this difficulty level set where you could just make an adjustment based on how good you are at this game for how much that energy creates a point, right? So we have it right now that four energy is the easy and one energy is hard. That means, or very hard, that means that every single energy is 1 point. And that's not true for the players in this game. It's every three energy is a point at the end of the game. But if you want to play on the easy setting, it's every four for the AI, or it's every single energy for the AI if you want it to be tough. And I thought that was a really, really clever way to just make a quick, simple adjustment to how difficult it was to beat the AI in this game.
Well, and the other thing too is that setting is in scoring. So you can't even just kind of play the game and ignore how many points the bot has. And then at the end go, oh, if the bot was hard, I would win. But if it was very hard, I would lose. So you know, you can kind of like, because like,
you're like, I won on the easy side.
Well, some people like, because solo games have like lots of different scales of like how you succeed or fail. Like some of them are like, you get a score and you look at this chart and it's like 40 points. You're a master gardener. 50 points. Your roses are worldwide. You know, oh, 10 points. Yeah, you should probably, you know, you should probably just buy your roses at the store. So, you know, like you have all these different scales of what, you know, kind of what players are You know, like a high score chase kind of thing. And then you also have games where you play against something and trying to win or lose. Like, I'm trying to beat the robot. And you have other games where you're just playing, you know. So, like, there's, like, lots of kind of different modes. And I also liked that because it meant that you could almost high score chase in a way. Or you could just, you could say, all right, well, the bot is playing on hard. Did I win or did I lose? Or you could say at the end of the game, oh, I got level 2. You know, I beat normal. Cool. Oh, this game I beat hard. So, like, you know, you can kind of do that range of, like, not only measuring success, but also having a win-loss condition, too. So it does both at the same time. It's kind of cool. And, yeah, it was simple. Like, it just, like, I don't, like, it just a simple solution that, like, didn't require a whole ton, you know, because I've played a good range of solo games, and some of them, like, include, you know, massive flow charts and tons of extra components and, like, an extra, you know, deck with these cards, and, like, this one's like a page rules and use the cards you're already using. It's pretty.
Yeah. And yeah. The other thing that I want to talk about is kind of the brilliance of kind of that, the brain behind the AI, where each planet has a designation that it will stay or skip, so the AI doesn't have to pay any amount of energy to go more than one space. But it has a set of rules, an if-then, that it will land on a planet if certain conditions are met. So each planet has its own kind of condition, right?
Yep.
One thing that we realized that it lacked some clarification in the first printing of Sovereign Skies. By the way, the second printing of Sovereign Skies is in effect, and I believe those are actually hitting stores as we speak. But we did update it in the rule book, and I know John made an addendum in BGG so that Wyrn, when you're actually moving ships. So there's a movement action, and what it allows you to do is consolidate your drop ships so that it makes it a little easier for you to build bases faster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for an AI, that's not, for a dumb AI as this one is, it's not as easy for it to kind of figure out what it needs to do. So you need to think about, okay, if it's going to move a ship, you go clockwise, you grab a ship, where is it going to go? Yep. Well, the first one is going to go to the one with the least amount of ships, right?
Yeah.
One thing I think we left out is, well, once it hits the required amount of ships for that planet, it should probably skip that as well, not just keep building up ships where it doesn't need them. And I think that's what we made clarifications on, and it made the robot a little bit smarter.
Yep. It's a thing where, like, that is a, like, you know, a space like get 2 energy plus 1 for every base you have, that's not a hard decision to make. Do you want the energy or not? Yeah. I certainly do. But, you know, the moving of the game and then, like, choosing what card to purchase and some stuff like that, those are decisions that players can make. And you can argue all day and go, well, I think this decision is better than that one. And at the end of the game, it's hard to tell exactly, purchasing that exact card is the entire reason you won and or lost. Like, you know, so, like, it's tough to say. So you have to really, it's not about making the AI make the best decision possible. It's about making it make a decision that kind of just goes, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Right. So like, really, it was like, the AI is not going to do the best thing possible always, but you want it to at least feel like you're playing against, I stress the second letter, intelligence. You don't want to feel like, because I have certainly played some games, even, you know, like computer games and stuff where you're playing against robotic opponents, or board games where you're playing against some sort of fake artificial intelligence. And they just make a move and you're like, wow, a human would never do that unless they just absolutely, you know, roll to die and pick the space, you know, like, that doesn't make any sense. So I think it's as long as it feels believable and you're like, huh, okay, yeah, I see its strategy. It's trying to group the ships together. That's good. You know, and like, does it have to be perfect? Not really, you know, that's part of it too, right? If you're playing a board game, you're never going to make the perfect set of moves. You know, that's
no, and your opponents make mistakes, yeah. And it needs to feel competitive, mm-hmm. without without getting too fiddly so that it feels totally simulated. Yeah. Like, you don't want to simulate another player. That's just you playing yourself.
Right.
So it needs to just have a simple rule set mm-hmm. where it feels like, okay, it's removing some things that I might need, or it's taking certain things away from mm-hmm. me. And dominating in places. And by accident or not, that's going to feel like you need to kind of fight against that. And that's the competitive mm-hmm. part of the game, where the AI comes in and gives you that simulation in the most efficient way possible.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, again, it's just, I think with the AI, it was just like, it's the illusion of playing against another player. It's not actually, you know, it breaks a couple of the rules in ways that, you know, just shortcut you having to sit through another player's turn. Because again, you could absolutely just pull the game out and play both sides, right? It's not like there's much, there's actually no hidden information, right? So like, you're not really hiding things from one another. It's not like, you know, you have cards that are telling you what your secret goal, like, you just, it's all on the table. So you could play a two-player game against yourself, but that experience is already in the box. We were trying to provide a different experience of that little AI of giving you kind of like I said, either like the high score chase or the win-loss condition, you know. So like, it's there, it's nice. And you know, I think honestly, I know there's a gentleman in the forums that has a spreadsheet where he had played many, many games and just enjoyed it so much. And I mean, like, I did too. I don't know. I made it, and I worked with you on it a little bit, developed on it a little bit. And then I just played it, I mean, goodness, a good 30, 40 times. Just,
yeah, we played a lot.
It was just fun. Like, me and you kind of sat there, and we, like, in Tabletop Sim, just kind of playing it over and over again. In nights, just kind of testing to see if it had any weird hiccups, and you know, it just felt good. It just felt fun.
Yeah,
you know?
It did. Yeah, and one other thing that I think worked out really well with the solo version too was that, you know, it's a rondel that has kind of variability, because each one of those planets can sit in any order, mm-hmm. right? If you randomize that order of what planet comes next, because it makes a difference in gameplay. If something, you know, if activating a base is the next space over from building a base, that game will possibly go a lot faster than if it's four spaces away, three spaces away, right on the opposite side of the board.
Right.
Because you're talking about spending energy to get there if you want to get those chits right away. So that variability also affects how smart the AI appears to be mm-hmm. as well,
right?
Because it has specific conditions that it's skipping certain planets for. It might hit a row of planets where, no, it's going to do that, it's going to do that, and it's going to seem like it's doing the smartest thing ever. And it's just happens to be mm-hmm. that randomized order that goes in, and that's going to change from game to game based on the order of those planets. Yep.
Well, and to even flip this back, that also, you know, variable player experience, right? Because the boards are always set up in a little different order, so you can't just do the exact same chain of actions every time. And whereas it might be build a base, activate a base in order, well, in this game, you can go the other direction. So if you're going, you know, if clockwise it's build a base, activate a base, go, if you flip around, go counterclockwise, now they're in the wrong order. Oh no. So now I'm going back this way, and now it takes me a ton of spaces. So now I have to consider, do I want to turn around?
That's true.
So like, it's actually interesting in that it, you know, it provides a really good experience. And I think that's also an interesting thing too, because a lot, some rondel games, depending on the game, will have it as a fixed thing. So I think some people like Takanoko is kind of like a good example of one where it's kind of fixed. Like the spaces yeah. are what they are. They're in the same order every time. Although it's not a circle, it's a line, but you get it. It's still kind of the same mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. Same idea. But with that one, you know, and there's still variable stuff in the spaces you go to, so it's going to change from game to game. But you know, here it's going to be a random order every time. And I think, you know, that's an interesting part is, I think in like that game, as opposed to this game, those are positioned intentionally to make you make hard decisions. Here, they're positioned randomly to present different decisions. And sometimes those decisions will be easy because it's like, well, build the base, activate the base in the right order. But again, we made it easy going clockwise. Now it's hard going counterclockwise. So now that decision is back the other, it presents potentially the easiest and hardest of solutions both at the same time. So like
Yeah, exactly. And there are games where you might not turn around ever, because it just happens to be that all the planets are in the order that you kind of need them to be in for you to most efficiently get the points you need to win the game.
Oh, we definitely play tested a game at one Unpub where at the end of the game, somebody, you can turn around. I remember that. Just I don't remember who it was, but I remember somebody saying that. And we're like, yeah, we've been doing it the whole time. You're not. Okay. Yeah. Well,
Yeah. And then there are other games where you might be like, God, I have to keep turning around because the thing that I want is right behind me.
Yeah.
And the next thing I want is right behind me again.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's super interesting to try and figure that puzzle out of you can't do it all the time. The energy economy is not that loose. It's, you know, so you have to figure out when am I going to sacrifice and just go, well, I guess I don't get to turn around. I mean, I have to take some other action. What's it going to be? Where am I going to kind of take the action that is less than desired and figure out, well, do I just take the drop ship? Do I just take the card? Maybe I want both. Maybe this action wasn't so bad anyways. So, I mean, this game just, it presents so many good decisions. And, you know, the other thing, I think this one's both a pro and a con. I see it as more of a pro than a con. The game's short. It's really short. Like, I've played a two-player game in like 25 minutes.
Yeah.
It's insane that, it just whips through so fast. And I think for a lot of people, they want the game to be more lengthy and in-depth. But having said that, there are so many games out there. There is almost undoubtedly something that matches your exact specifications. And I think this one matches mine when it comes to amount of game length, right? Because some games definitely do like overstay their welcome where they're there for way too long. You know, I know people always make the joke about, Twilight Imperium taking ages and ages and ages. And I mean, I find that game, fits where I want it to be. Like it feels about when I play a game of it, I feel satisfied in game length and whatnot. But some people just look at it and go, oh, that game takes 6 hours. I don't want to play something for 6 hours. But it takes how many hours to cook a brisket? And I would definitely do that. So, just a thing where like, it's all up to personal taste. And I think that the shorter length is kind of a trend in that games are pulling down in like complexity and time and whatever. And I think it just hits such a sweet spot where there's enough think there, there's enough play there. It's just long enough. And if it wasn't long enough, play it twice or three times.
Yeah. And you bring up something interesting too, which is there are kind of a couple of different types of games when it comes to kind of ending the game. One of them is you have a set number of rounds. You have a set number of seasons. Mm-hmm. You have a set number of a track that tracks how many rounds it's going to be. And originally we started out with it like that. It was like 16 rounds or something, and it changed by player count. Well, we got to a point where we realized kind of the same thing was happening after a certain amount of time. And that was that there were these stacks of chits being depleted. Now, having it be that when a stack is depleted, and it's really obvious because there are only three chits per stack, having those become the factor that ends the game gives the players a bit of control over when that ends. Mm-hmm. And some of the time, you have to, when you play, you think, should I extend this game a little bit longer so I can do more of the things I want? Or should I end it now knowing that that stack only has one left? And if I take it, I'm going to end this game. I think that's something that's really, really interesting in games. Mm-hmm. When you give the players some sort of power, some sort of agency about when that game can end or whether or not it can be extended. In a four-player game, honestly, if if all of the players are kind of skimming the top of all of the chit stacks, it can kind of go on. I've seen games that go longer than an hour, and then I've seen games that go 35, 45 minutes, a four-player game.
Yeah.
For the same thing. So there's something super interesting to me about that.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's lots of different ways to end a game. I think my favorite is just flipping the table, but there's a fixed number of rounds is also kind of like a thing where if you don't have a great way to keep track of it, sometimes that's a pain in the bum to keep track of. Oh, wait, did we remember to remove that marker? Anytime you require players to remember things like procedural steps, they get skipped. They're going to get skipped. Like we said earlier with the income, you could have just given each player 2 energy per turn and then they pay 1 energy per action, but they're going to forget every time.
Somebody's going to forget.
Right? Yep. And so forgetting the 1 energy for not taking an action, you're not really going to forget that because you're happy for that. And then when you're taking the 3rd action, you're not going to forget because you're happy to pay to get that 3rd action. So like it feels to me like you've tied them in with a lot better, call to actions, right? Like, I'm way less likely to forget to pay for my 3rd action than I am to forget my passive income, right?
Yeah, maybe Jeff Engelstein and Isaac Shalev could answer this, knowing as much as they do about the names of every mechanic in the universe, but I'm wondering if there is some sort of terminology for sort of engineering memory into the mechanics of your game, because that's so true that people forget to do the thing, the extra thing they're supposed to do kind of between a turn or at the end of a round. Oh, we have to move this marker down one. Mm-hmm. Oh, we have to do this thing. Because when you have to do something sort of without benefit or something you have to do on every time, when you're thinking about all this other stuff, something that's just fiddly, it tends to be forgotten. If there's a benefit to doing it, if it's engineered into the mechanics of the game, if you're saying, okay, when you see this happen, this other thing happens, and it's super obvious, it's super visual, that's sort of an engineered kind of memory moment where you don't have to rely on those players to remember something because they want that thing to happen or they know that that's going to happen. That's coming and it's obvious to them.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, again, this game kind of ties a lot of things together in ways that, like when you place a base, there's a reward you get for it, and it's listed right under it. So it makes sense. Oh, that's what happens there, because like it ties all the things together in nice little ways. And so I think that moving to the end piles is just like a really clever thing, because you're like, oh, I see that a pile is gone. Oh, I see that a second pile is gone. You know, like it just, instead of that kind of memory, like, and it felt like the game's played out more dynamically too, because now you have decisions, players have a little control. I think that's like a big thing with a lot of kind of the PAX games in general. I know those run a little heavier, a lot heavier. But those kind of, they have a lot of player pull on how the game is going and when it ends. And to have that control feels good, to be like, I could push the game closer to ending, or I could kind of diversify and get some points over here. And the thing is that pushing the game towards ending, you're pulling from a lower stack, so it's probably less points. So that is kind of a risk you take is, well, if I drill down this pile, I'm getting less points. And if they drill that pile, they're getting a lot of points. So then how do you balance that out of, I want to get a lot of points, but I also want to end the game while I have a lot of points. And then how do I finagle that? And that's those decisions coming in where this game has a good layer of strategy of, well, obviously the first thing you do is place drop ships. And then obviously the next thing you do is build bases. And then obviously the next thing you do is activate them. Great. You also have other players playing the game too, and they're doing these things too. And they're, you want to put the dropship so that you can get energy off other people moving their mothership. You want to be able to get the cards and buy the correct senators, give the abilities. You want to do all of these things too. And so they're throwing nice little wrinkles in the mix that just really stew this game into like a really, really hearty soup. There's just so many little carrots and potatoes that just make up this wonderful, wonderful broth. It's fantastic. And now I'm hungry. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I think you need to eat your dinner.
Yeah.
So the last thing I think I want to talk about before we check out is the Aaron Majority kind of aspect of this mm-hmm. game. When I originally designed the game, and I had it was sort of your typical area majority where at the end of a set of rounds, you know, you have your seasons or whatever that may be, mm-hmm. You were going to score your majorities and everybody kind of stopped gameplay. Okay. So the way we've been playing previously is now changing. We're now going to play this small little weird part where we count up all our ships, we count up all our bases, mm-hmm. and we see what we have. And then we score from that. We go up the score track or whatever that may be. Well, we realized that it was sort of interrupting game flow, because there's a game flow to a rondelle. You're going around, especially in a race game. You want to feel the tension of that sort of oncoming ending that you're trying to make sure that you have more points than everybody else before that ends finally, right? And this interruption, we wanted to engineer that out. How do we design out your typical count the points for majorities at certain intervals? And we didn't want to do it at the end of the game either, because as anyone knows who's ever played an area majority game, the last person to play, the last player has a distinct advantage always,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, they're putting the lid on the jar, right? I mean, you know, they get to seal it.
You can load up. Yep, you can load up right before you score. So how do we do that in a dynamic fashion? And I remember us trying like various things. We had these little track. We had other things that were like, oh, what is this? What is this other planet that we took out this sort of take that mechanic that was a little disruptive, a little boring. It was sort of this card that popped up that you didn't want, and you had to go to the plant to get rid of it, sort of this insurrection that was happening. And what we found was like this little punishing thing was just more annoying than fun. And you definitely want to design out those things mm-hmm. that people find annoying. So this absolute ingenious moment came to Ian and I at one point where we said, what if you could, in order for you to score your majorities, you have to go score those majorities. You have to go to the planet where you score majorities, and you have to have the cards that match those planets and get rid of those cards in order to do that. And so we devised a way to collect points that actually can be taken away from you. And so that created this sort of competitiveness between who had control and who had majority. And in fact, we decided if you went and wanted to score a planet that you didn't even have majority for, as long as no one had tried to score that planet yet, you get to take those points. Now, those points can be taken away from you in sort of a, you know, a push and pull. But you, as long as you keep that at the end of the game, if no one challenges you, those are your 3 points. Mm-hmm. And that's a big 3-point swing in a game where your typical score is somewhere between 25 and 55, depending on how many players there are. That is a big swing, mm-hmm. especially if you have 3 of them. That's a 9-point swing. That's 9 points somebody else doesn't have that you have. Mm-hmm. Humongous. So this became a really, really interesting way to play this game. And in fact, we made it so you could even score cards and score planets that you got rid of for a point, even if you didn't have control of that planet. Mm-hmm. So it incentivized going there. And to incentivize going there early on, we actually took a note from a playtester who said, you know, people weren't trying to do that until later on in the game. Give me energy and I'll go there earlier. And we did. We just put a row of energy right underneath all of those chits. And the if you wanted to go and get energy in a really quick way and also get some early points in a really quick way, go to, and I have to lean over here and grab the planet, of course, but it's a purple planet, Alona, to pledge some of those politic cards that you might be spending otherwise on senators. Why not go and just get rid of them here, get some quick points, get some energy, and get those big points too, possibly, mm-hmm. and put those on your board. Now, those are going to be up again for grabs, but as long as you maintain control of those majorities on those planets, those are yours. And I just, it's one of the latest breaking kind of mechanics that we added to this game in development, and it is absolutely hands down my favorite. Of course, it's a Rondell game. I love the Rondell. I love that sort of limiting decision space, but this way to integrate area majority in a really dynamic way that doesn't interrupt game flow was just, for me, a great aha moment in designing this game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it also just layered on just the right amount of player interactivity where you do care about what other people are doing, you know, because I think that is some board games have just the full multiplayer solitaire experience where everybody is just doing their own thing. And at the end, you all kind of compare what you've done, do your show and tell project at the end of the game and go, look at me, I got 70 points. Look at me, I got, you know, what. So, and that can be fun. That's a fun thing. But then you also have games where you're right in each other's faces, punching and scratching. This game just has, I think, just a tiny little scratches. Not you know, it is definitely painful to lose one of those pledge chits, but it's, you have to work to get it out of somebody's hands. You got to make sure. And so, having said that, if I take a pledge chit, now I've got a decision. Am I perfectly satisfied with just hoping nobody wants to take it? Do I want to try and defend it? Am I cool with the energy I got out of it? So, like, there's a lot of little things going on there. And that, again, just adds those nice little wrinkles in, you know. So, I mean, really, it's like a nice little wave in the wave pool to really kind of mix up from game to game. And, yeah, it's super, like, it's what the game needed. I played earlier versions, and I thought that, you know, total area majority or area control kind of thing can be kind of tough to balance around. And that was like a really happy medium of, you know, the two kind of area majority mechanics are like those tokens, the pledge tokens, being a thing that you can take from somebody by beating them. And then also just getting an energy when somebody goes on a space you're the leader in. So I like those small, subtle nods that give that area majority vibe without just like totally piling in on the game to make it exactly only that. I love it. Love it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so that's Sovereign Skies. Sovereign Skies is a wonderful game. Plays from 1 to 4 players. Takes anywhere, I think we have on the box, this 30, it says 45 minutes on the box. So I think in that range is pretty good.
It's an average. Yep. Yeah.
It's by Deepwater Games. fantastic game. Second printing coming out. And it's a beauty. It's a very fun, nice, tight little Euro. With some cool mechanics going on, really, really utilizes the Rondell in such a magnificent way. Definitely worth checking out. We definitely had a blast in the journey to get from beginning to here. And I hope you give it a shot. Enjoy.
Yeah. So I think, you know, one thing that we want to do with the podcast here is kind of focus on a game, talk about the mechanics, and, you know, we thought this was a really good place to start as far as our first game that we're focusing on fully for a whole entire episode, because John and I were both involved in its creation. And I don't know, as you might know, John and I are also working on the follow-up to Sovereign Skies called Sovereign Sons. Very, very different set of mechanics. We're not necessarily ready to dedicate a whole episode to that quite yet, until we're a little bit further down the line. But there are going to be more episodes coming up where we are talking about a specific game and all of the mechanics kind of involved in that game. And I think we're probably going to be alternating and talking about a specific mechanic for an episode and talking about that specific mechanic. So we still have an opportunity to just talk about Rondell games coming up too sometime in the future. Anyway, I really appreciate everybody who stuck with us and listening for the full hour. Thank you again for subscribing. I don't know if we want to start doing the thing where we talk about who we are and how you can get in touch with us. I don't know that it's important. John,
yeah. Anything you want to say about that? Best place to find me in my wild thoughts, the Angry Tetris on Twitter. That's where I put my heart and soul and sometimes sweat and you know, embarrassing stories about showing up to high school in my dream without underwear.
And you can always find me on Twitter at Internet's Magic.
Plural.
That's a
plural.
An account that I've had for a very long time. So there you go.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time on the Cardboard Mechanics Podcast.